A major cause of hospital readmissions, the lowdown on blood clots. It's known in the medical community as deep vein thrombosis, or DVT, and is one of the most common causes of death in hospitals. In fact, blood clots, according to one authority, kill more people every year than AIDS, breast cancer, and motor vehicle accidents combined. And the most frightening thing is that many people are unaware that they have a clot. And the problem is believed to be underreported. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll talk with a panel of experts on the front lines of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of DVTs, and find out what we can do to minimize the risks. We'll also learn about the latest advancements in treatment. Deep vein thrombosis, what you should know about blood clots. Today on Maine Caller. First, this news. From the Maine Public Broadcasting Studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Blood clots can occur in just about anywhere in the body and can be caused by a variety of conditions. Some help to stop bleeding and help begin the healing process. Others can require immediate medical attention and are life-threatening. Today we have three doctors in the studio to help us learn more about just what blood clots are, how we can detect and prevent them, and what to do if we have one. Dr. Cindy Asbjornsson is founder of the Vein Healthcare Center in South Portland. Dr. Paul Kim is Assistant Director of Vascular and Interventional Services for Spectrum Medical Group. And Dr. Wes Zemrak is Doctor of Pharmacy and Anticoagulation Specialist at Maine Medical Center. And of course, we want to hear from you. Our number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to Maine Calling, all of you.
Thank you.
So this is, we should say up front, Blood Clot and DVT Awareness Month. Apart from that, Cindy Asbjornsson, why should we care about this particular medical issue?
Well, we should care because basically it's a life-threatening situation, can be a life-threatening situation that can affect many, many people. In Maine alone last year, we had over 1,000 deaths related to deep vein thrombosis. Nationally, we have more deaths from deep vein thrombosis than prostate cancer, breast cancer, AIDS, and traffic accidents combined. So this is a real big problem that deserves a little awareness to help us all prevent it.
But we never, it seems to me, though, we never hear about it as a cause of death. Does it cause other conditions that we talk more about as the source of the death?
Well, it definitely causes other conditions, but I don't know if they get much publicity either. And that's why we have March Awareness Month. And curiously, this was started just over 10 years ago, I guess 11 years ago now, when a famous reporter had an incident that
David Bloom of NBC
brought this situation into the public light. And since then, awareness has been building, but it still fails and falls far behind all of the other diseases I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Paul Kim, what is a deep vein thrombosis or DVT?
So basically, it's when there's a clot or some sort of obstruction, let's say, in one of your deep veins, usually in the legs, the most common. And when that happens, the usual first symptoms are leg pain and swelling fairly acutely. And that's usually the first sign that something has gone awry. The problem with DVT is sort of twofold. One is the life-threatening condition that can result is pulmonary embolism, or when that clot gets dislodged from the leg vein, it travels upwards and then goes into the chest. When that happens, that can cause significant problems with, you know, your breathing and chest pain and that sort of thing. And that is a part that can be life-threatening. The second part is with the clot itself in the vein. What started to become more well-known is that over time, that clot can actually cause damage to the veins itself and cause those veins to not function as well. And that's despite the usual standard of care.
So the clot could travel and cause a pulmonary embolism or other problem, but it could stay in place and wreak havoc right there and where it's staying.
Correct, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In the case of David Bloom, which you referenced, my recollection of that case is he did complain. He was covering the war in Iraq. He was spending a lot of time cramped in a military vehicle, and he complained of pain behind his knee. Mm-hmm. Doctors suspected it might be a DVT. He decided to continue working and take aspirin, and eventually it killed him. Does everyone get a warning sign?
Unfortunately, no. You know, so if the clot originates quick enough and then dislodges fast enough, then it can cause a pulmonary embolism without that prerequisite leg pain and swelling. And it's sort of part of the DVT awareness that needs to happen is not just initial symptoms, that's probably the most important for most people, but also the risk factors. So for him, you know, transatlantic or transcontinental flight followed by long periods of immobility. For other people, if there's other illnesses, that can also increase your risk of forming a blood vein clot or recent surgery. All of those things are high, are significant risk factors. Oral contraceptives is another, and so is smoking.
Dr. Zemirak, so Dr. Kim mentioned the cross-country flight or the long flights, which we have heard about as, I think it's economy class syndrome or something, which is a long flight. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but has that been? I've also seen studies since then that have said no, there is no increased risk. What's the lowdown on that? Should we get up in the middle of a flight to minimize the risk?
Absolutely. I'm going to jump right in on that one. We know there are three big settings or risk factors that cause these kind of clots. And the first one is simply being static or sitting for too long. If you have immobility, you are at risk, and that can be from sitting on a plane for too long, playing a video game for too long, anything that keeps you in bed. Of course, the most classic situation where this happens is when you're in a hospital bed. The second big risk group are people who have hypercoagulable states or a situation that makes their blood more clotty. And we have two different groups of those people, the people who are born with problems or a congenital disorder of hypercoagulability, the most common being factor V Leiden disorder. The second being people who acquire these states, and that can be an acquired state like pregnancy or contracting a disease process like cancer that will make you more hypercoagulable, but anything that puts you into the group of having blood that clots too easily.
Okay, so I'm going to use clotty blood rather than hypercoagulability.
Absolutely.
I can't
much
do
easier
it.
To say.
Okay.
But then just let me get out to that third group. I don't want to forget them.
Yeah.
Are anyone who has had any kind of trauma or damage to a blood vessel. And that can be something as dramatic as a surgery or as simple as, you know, just taking a spill or bumping an elbow and, you know, causing a bruise. Any kind of trauma to a blood vessel can set you up to have one of these clots.
Okay. So, and let's back up a little bit and talk about coagulability. First of all, we need to have our blood. Our blood has to clot, otherwise we could die of a paper cut.
Yes. Definitely.
So how does that? What is that process going on when blood clots?
Sure. So certainly there's a fine balance that we want to achieve between clotting and bleeding. You know, I essentially try to explain, you do take that paper cut example that you have. You know, there's a certain period of time it sends off signals at the site of that paper cut. You develop a state of all kinds of markers and all kinds of clotting factors developing at that site to develop a plug, if you will, to stop the blood from flowing forward and flowing out, essentially. And over time, essentially, that blood clot there stabilizes the area, heals the area, and then ultimately you want that blood clot to naturally dissolve. And you have natural anticoagulation factors or blood thinning factors inside your body that ultimately do its job over time and take care of that blood clot, and it dissolves away. It's these certain instances that Cindy alluded to that where you have too many, maybe those clotting factors are too many and you get a larger blood clot that's hard for your body to handle by itself. And you can also have some deficiencies in your natural anticoagulation system as well.
So a blood clot could be in the process of being naturally broken down, but it's too big to totally process, and so then it breaks free and does its damage?
Actually, let me speak to that one as well. I'm sorry, I'm kind of hogging
That's
the microphone
okay.
here.
But you're a team. Here,
so. when you have a clot, we talk about occlusive and non-occlusive clots, or clots that kind of fill up the whole pipe or leave half open. And if you have flow around a clot, your body has a really good chance of breaking it down. But as soon as that clot takes up the whole hose, more or less, pressure can build behind it. And when we talk about blood vessels, we have our arteries that are very high pressured. We have our superficial veins, which are relatively low pressured. Then we have our deep veins that are right in the middle. And if you have a clot in a deep vein and it completely plugs up the whole tube, eventually the pressure will build behind it that can be so great that can cause it to let go or embolize. And this was one of those points I was hoping I'd have a chance to make. In the world of veins and vein care and vein problems and processes, we like three-letter acronyms. So we talk a lot about DVTs, or deep vein thrombosis. And people always ask, well, what's the difference between a DVT and a VTE, or a venous thromboembolism? And the difference is really the DVT, or the clot, is when it's stuck in the pipe, and then the embolism is when it just lets go and starts to move. And like Dr. Kim said, the most likely place for it to go is to return with your venous return to your heart and let your heart pump it someplace, normally to your lungs. But if you're one of most likely about a third of the population who has a little communication in their heart, it could get pumped directly up to your brain and be a stroke as well. So these are definitely serious, serious situations.
They are serious. And in fact, the phrase "silent killer" comes to mind, which is overused in media coverage of these kinds of things, silent killer. But in this case, does it not apply, Dr. Kim, a little bit?
It does. I think the thing to keep in mind is, one is, even though if I backtrack a little bit, there are risk factors for DVT. I think the last thing that probably we also want to see is a lot of patients come to the emergency department saying, I have a bruise on my leg. Do I have a DVT? Or, I've been lying in bed from the flu for 3 days. Do I have a DVT? It's unfortunately, they're still the clinical signs are what you primarily have to go by, and that is leg pain and swelling. The truth of the matter is that if you do throw an embolus, the vast majority of it, the great percentage of it are survivable, and that is true. Then they get subcategorized into massive PE, which is immediately life-threatening, and then a submassive category, which is somewhere in the gray area. The standard of care, which is still true to this day, is blood thinning. Some sort of medication that you're given, either in shot form or pill form, that helps and has been shown very significantly to reduce that risk of clot going to the lungs. The important thing for, I think, people to realize, and maybe a misconception, is that blood thinning agent doesn't actually dissolve the clot. All it does is it keeps your body's blood thin to either prevent clot from propagating or getting worse, but you still rely on your own body's normal mechanism to eventually dissolve the clot, and that takes time.
So Dr. Zemirak, we heard in the case of David Bloom, as I said, he had an inkling that something was wrong, and he talked to physicians, according to the account that I read, and decided instead to take aspirin and hope that that took care of it. What does aspirin do?
Sure. So aspirin, one of our oldest, I guess, anticoagulants, aspirin is actually an antiplatelet medication, which helps to prevent platelets sticking together, which, as we were talking about, with the start of that clot forming, the platelet is actually one of the first one to arrive on the scene and start that clot to start forming. So aspirin helps in that sense to prevent from the clot getting bigger from a platelet perspective, but doesn't really do a whole lot from the other aspects of the coagulation.
One of the common treatments, I had a bone surgery at one point, and the regimen after that, this was 20 years ago maybe, was Coumadin treatment and regular monitoring of blood. What is Coumadin and how does it work?
Sure. Warfarin or Coumadin, the brand name, most people recognize it by that one. Warfarin is again, an older anticoagulant that we have, and it's kind of our old standby. We've had that medication for a really long period of time. Warfarin acts differently from the antiplatelets, where it does inhibit some of those clotting factors. So what it does is it helps to prevent the production of what's called vitamin K-dependent clotting factors. And there's certain ones in your body that rely on your intake of vitamin K. So we all eat, the most common green leafy vegetables, a lot of people think. You also get vitamin K from other places as well. But warfarin prevents the production of those clotting factors, and that will ultimately help the blood clot from not getting any larger. It does take a fair amount of time to work. So what we usually do, as Dr. Kim alluded to, is put you on an IV medication as well, an intravenous shot medication. Whether that's in the hospital setting, we use a product called heparin or Lovenox, an oxaparin, that's another one. And we can also do that in the outpatient setting too. So outside of the emergency department or the hospital setting, we can use that medication as well.
Okay. We've got a lot of questions coming in, a few emails, Facebook messages, and phone calls as well. We'll go to those after we take a short break. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by TechPort, offering iPad repair and return service statewide by mail, Mac certified and locally owned. Learn more at techportmaine.com. And by Revision Energy, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems. RevisionEnergy.com.
Next time on Living on Earth, discovering synthetic biology, how very fast computers make it possible to create life using binary code.
The DNA code, the ACs, Gs, and Ds are becoming interchangeable with the digital code of the computer, and we can now go in both directions.
It opens up new frontiers in health, food, and space exploration. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tune in for Living on Earth, Sunday morning at 7. Many television viewers watch MPBN on Time Warner Cable. If you're among them, please note Time Warner Cable is adjusting their channel lineup, and it will affect what channel you can find your MPBN channels on, including our main channel, World, Create, and Maine Capital Connection. Time Warner plans to adjust their channels statewide, but right now the adjustments are affecting just southern Maine, Cumberland and York counties, and eastern New Hampshire. The MPBN main channel is on channel 10, but the high-definition main channel is at 1221. World is at 1276, and Maine Capital Connection channel at 1277. Also, Create is at 1278. For more information, you can visit our website, mpbn.net, or call Audience Services at 800-884-1717. And thanks.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, detecting, treating, and trying to prevent blood clots. With me in the studio, Dr. Wes Zemrak is Doctor of Pharmacy and Anticoagulation Specialist at Maine Medical Center. He's been an assistant professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of New England and is currently the Anticoagulation Specialist at Maine Med. Dr. Paul Kim, Assistant Director of Vascular and Interventional Services for Spectrum Medical Group. He currently serves as principal investigator of a national NIH-sponsored clinical trial on a new treatment for deep venous thrombosis. And Dr. Cindy Asbjornsen is founder of the Vein Healthcare Center and one of only five vein specialists in Maine to be certified by the American Board of Phlebology. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, the number 1-800-399-3566, email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. As promised, to Mount Desert or Mount Desert, depending upon where you're from. And Steve, hi, Steve.
Hi. Mount Desert, if you're from there. so my question is, how effective has preoperative mini-dose heparin or other anticoagulants been in reducing deaths from embolism?
Who wants to take that? Dr. Zemrak?
I'll take Paul? A shot. Yeah, I think it's, your question is a pretty good one in that I think the data has been a little not so precise. It's been shown with either, so the subcutaneous heparin shot that tends to be given or with what we call the sequential compression devices on the legs for high-risk patients. So let's say those patients are undergoing like a hip replacement or very medically ill patients that in the hospital setting, it will reduce the incidence of DVT. in terms of number of lives saved and changes in survival, morbidity, mortality, that I don't know the answer to. I think the incidence of DVT has been shown to be less. The number of deaths prevented, that I'm not sure on.
Can you explain the mechanism of why is surgery such a risk factor in deep vein thrombosis?
So it kind of goes back to what Cindy was saying earlier. It's sort of a twofold hit. One is, especially for major surgeries, the ones that require inpatient stays, you're going to have a fairly prolonged period of immobility both during the operation and post-procedure after the operation where just due to the recovery, you're not going to be very ambulatory. And when you're not very ambulatory, you have somewhat more static blood flow in the legs, particularly when you're lying down. And so because of that, you know, when blood doesn't move, it clots. It's sort of the bottom line. The other is if there is some sort of trauma induced, even intentional because you're working on the lower extremity, whether it's due to swelling or just from local inflammation, then that also increases the risk of clot forming in the leg.
So it has nothing to do with the fact that you're being cut. I mean, the people who don't follow this will think, oh, I'm having surgery, so there's bleeding and somehow clots get into the system. But it's really about the stopping of the movement of blood through the veins that sets up, same with sitting in this crouched position or,
sure.
or you know, being in a chair or something like that, right?
Right. And with this is a classic situation where just understanding these risk factors can actually save your life. Once you have one of these surgeries or you're at risk for any reason, you're in the hospital bed, you've had surgery, you're immobile, little things that you can do, just moving your feet back and forth, pointing your toes, you know, as extending as far as you can, flexing as far as you can, will give you a nice rhythmic calf contraction. That's going to help pump the blood out of your legs back up towards your heart. Getting up and walking around sooner rather than later. When you feel lousy and the physical therapist comes in, nobody wants to get up. So push yourself and try to get out of the bed when they recommend it. Little things like that can truly save your life.
All right, let's go to Wilton and Greg. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I have fairly substantial varicose veins in my left leg. I was wondering, am I in any... have any risk of getting those blood clots?
And we see varicose veins, they're very visual, and we might have a visceral reaction that, oh, gee, there's something threatening going on there.
Absolutely. I'm happy to take this one. Oftentimes, varicose veins are visible because they are in your superficial venous system. And a superficial vein problem doesn't necessarily equal a deep venous problem. However, many varicose veins happen because of a connection to a deep venous problem. And that's why we're becoming more and more aggressive in searching out these type of problems and helping people address them either through compression stockings or with intervention. So I would recommend to anyone with varicose veins to talk to your primary care doctor, establish your risk. You know, if you have varicose veins, there's turbulent flow someplace in your leg, and finding the source of that can, again, be a very powerful step towards health.
Yeah, so, and what is the cause of varicose veins?
Oftentimes it's valve failure, or the way a vein works is a little complex, but basically the heart will pump the blood through arteries to a place where an artery connects with a vein at a very small, small level. At that point, a pressure is measured at about zero. So the blood doesn't have an easy way to make it back up to the heart through the veins. And the way we do that is through either elevation, although since we walk on our feet, our legs are at a disability there, or through these series of valves. And most of our leg veins have intact valve systems that work just like check valves in plumbing, where with every step you take or every muscle contraction you make, you are literally pumping the blood up out of your lower extremity. What happens with varicose veins is a valve will break or rupture or become damaged in some way, shape, or form that will lead to backflow or reflux of the blood and allow the blood that should be heading towards your heart to turn around and start heading towards your feet. And this can be a setup for many problems.
This happened with my heating system at home. It was not as serious. Let's go. Greg, did that answer your question?
Yeah, pretty much, I guess. There's a lot more to it than what I thought. But it was the blood clots that concerned me, because I saw that news there where David Bloom passed away, and that was the first thing I thought of was, geez, if I have blood clots in my varicose veins, I mean, that could happen to me at any time, you know.
So it is uncommon for superficial veins like that you have. It sounds like the varicose veins, for those to break off and lead to a pulmonary embolism, which is what killed David Bloom. That gives you some peace of mind. I think what Cindy said was very accurate, though, in that if you do have varicose veins, it probably is a good idea to, at the very least, talk with your primary care provider about being further evaluated, because what that then may do is unmask or help us dig a little bit deeper as to why you develop those varicose veins to begin with. But a clot that forms in the varicose veins themselves, statistically, is very low risk for developing a PE.
So, and what role do these sort of compression stockings play? Do they come in and bolster what your body isn't able to do?
They help. They help a lot. And when you say compression stockings, we have to pause for a minute and qualify the difference between a regular, I think when someone hears the word compression stockings, they immediately think these thick, white, awful things they wore in the hospital one time when. And I always like to put the plug in for modern compression and graduated compression, both of which are much more comfortable, much more tolerable on a daily basis, and much more effective when you're in a standing position. So the difference being a TED stocking or a thick white stocking that you might wear in the hospital is universal compression. It's the same squeeze all the way up your leg. The new modern graduated compression stockings, for vein patients, we often use 20 to 30 millimeters of mercury. And what that means is you might have a 30 millimeter of mercury squeeze at your ankle, but it might drop down to 25 mid-calf, 20 at the knee, 15 in your low thigh, 10 in your mid-thigh, 5 in your high thigh. And it provides a funnel-shaped pressure to work the blood up your leg to help augment what your muscles are naturally doing, and also to compensate for the effect of gravity that you feel as soon as you stand up.
Okay. And was this would these be recommended for anyone or just people at risk?
Definitely people at risk. But for me, I'll recommend anyone over the age of 50 with any risk factor. And I include anyone who's going to be in a car driving for, you know, 3 or 4 hours, anybody flying for even an hour, because that hour flight will often include surrounding time where you're stuck in that seat not moving. So anyone who's going to increase their risk level would benefit from a graduated compression stocking. I'm going to look around and see if everybody agrees.
I see some nodding.
Not so much. I think the issue sometimes is with compliance, because they're not, we were talking about this outside, they're not always the easiest to get on, especially for the more elderly population. And the tolerability, especially in the summertime, is not as high. For instance, the ATTRACT clinical DVT trial, the protocol is for even stronger strength for patients that have had a DVT, so the 30 to 40 strength, which is a pressure gradient. And, you know, that strength has been shown in some of these population studies to reduce the risk of, to some degree, the chronic pain and swelling that can happen after a DVT.
Interesting. Okay. Let's go to Bruce in Yarmouth. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
I was wondering what the panel thinks about. I'm a pharmacist in a local hospital, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the factor 10A inhibitors and what role they may become to play, not just in the outpatient setting, but in the inpatient setting, in terms of perhaps overtaking warfarin and heparinoids for DVT prophylaxis, DVT treatment, PE treatment, and atrial fibrillation.
Dr. Zimmerman?
Sure, definitely. It's a great question. You know, I spoke before that warfarin was our old standby, and we've had that for a very long time. Most recently, we have a new medication called rivaroxaban. The brand name is Xarelto. That's a new medication that works a little bit differently, similarly to the IV medications that we've had used in the past to transition people to Coumadin. This medication has pluses and minuses along the same lines, similar to warfarin, has plus and minuses. This agent does not require the routine monitoring that Keith alluded to before, having to go get your blood checked weekly like warfarin may take. It has less drug interactions than warfarin does. It has less dietary interactions than warfarin does. So there certainly are a lot of appeals, but some cons to it. It goes through your kidneys to be removed from your body. So in patients with any kind of kidney dysfunction, you may need to have a reduced dose or you may not be a candidate for this medication at all versus warfarin not requiring your kidneys. The other thing is we don't have a specific way to reverse the agent like we do with warfarin. If someone is bleeding because of that agent, we can reverse it relatively quickly with several different medications. We certainly don't have that one true antidote with the newer drugs. So that's kind of a drawback as well. But the advantage is that it's easier to take. You don't have to do the monitoring. The other factor, too, that it comes up a lot is it is brand new. It's brand name only. It's also pretty expensive. But if you compare it to the lab testing and all the things that take with warfarin, it's kind of it may be a wash as far as a cost perspective. So
okay, let's go to Cherry Field and Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hello. You were talking before about varicose veins, and I was wondering about spider veins, which are those, you know, little veins that you get sometimes.
Okay, Cindy S. Burnson.
So the way I think of spider veins is, you know, all doctors, we like to put things on scales. And in the world of veins, we talk about a clinical severity rating. And C1 is just those little spider veins and reticular veins. C2 is when those veins start to bubble out and become varicose. C3 is when you start to see swelling in your feet all the time. C4 is when your ankles turn sort of a bluish color from all the little veins and you can get some brown stains on your lower legs. And then C5 and 6 are when you start getting venous stasis ulcers. That's not to say every person with spider veins is going to end up with an ulcer, but it is to say that a spider vein can be a very early sign of a venous problem that needs attention. And sometimes just wearing a graduated compression sock, if you know these are on your lower leg, a knee sock would probably be enough, that this could prevent any sort of future venous problems or progression of this spider vein into anything worse. So again, I'm going to encourage you to talk to your primary care doctor about the spider veins, talk about the continuum and how to prevent spider veins from ever getting worse.
And just to be clear, you're all physicians, but you're not giving our listeners direct medical advice. You have to come visit you and become a patient and all of that. This is sort of general
Absolutely.
Advice, and we just want to make that clear, as we always do in these types of programs. Right now, though, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments, including Irv in Brunswick, who we'll talk to after the break. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by The Cedars, a nonprofit senior living community in Portland since 1929, offering state-of-the-art rehabilitation, thecedarsportland.org, and by Maine Community Health Options, Maine's new nonprofit and member-led health insurance option. Learn more at maineoptions.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how four alleged members of rival prison gangs, each housed in solitary confinement, organized a hunger strike to protest their conditions. We talk with Benjamin Wallace Wells about his New York Magazine article, The Plot from Solitary. And we hear from Craig Haney, a psychologist who studies the psychological effects of solitary. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. If you are a fan of MPBN Television's Doc Martin program and you live near Ellsworth and you're looking for something to do tonight, MPBN has an invitation for you. Doc Martin viewers have been anxiously waiting for the premiere of Season 6, which MPBN Television will broadcast on Thursday and Saturday evenings, March 13th and 15th. However, if you'd like to see the first episode in Season 6 even earlier and mingle with other Doc Martin fans, MPBN will be showing it at the Grand Theater in Ellsworth tonight at 7. Doors open at 6:15. Tickets are free. However, you must reserve your tickets in advance online at mpbn.net. Just click on Events. We hope to see you there this evening.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, answers to your questions about blood clots. With me in the studio, Dr. Paul Kim. He's Assistant Director of Vascular and Interventional Services for Spectrum Medical Group. Dr. Cindy Asbjornsen, she's founder of the Vein Healthcare Center in South Portland, and Dr. Wes Zamrak, Doctor of Pharmacy and Anticoagulation Specialist at Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Irv in Brunswick in a moment, but first, Susan writes via email, my mother has a history of DVTs, and she told me it was more likely for me to develop these. Is this true? And if so, how much of an increased risk do I have, and what additional precautions should I take?
The short answer is maybe. The long answer is quite a bit more detailed. Whenever we do hear of a family history of a clotting problem or disorder in the past, it raises the possibilities of what Cindy mentioned earlier of having some sort of genetic predisposition to having blood that tends to like to clot. And there's numerous...
Clotty blood.
Correct, clotty blood. And there's numerous types of diseases that can cause this, as well as each of those come with a different level of risk and therefore a little different recommendations. The short answer is probably if you're... close family member has multiple DVTs in the past, but you have not, and there's not at this time any role for definitive screening, just because there's a multitude of hereditary and genetic problems that can happen, and it's impossible to screen for all of them.
But you could, if you inherited a rheumatoid arthritis or any mm-hmm. of these other diseases, which could contribute to your propensity to develop this problem.
Yeah, I think if you do have any risk factors that we mentioned earlier for forming a DVT, or if you do obviously notice any of the symptoms of leg pain and swelling, that would be the first step in getting treatment. And then based on that, that would probably at least have a physician look into more detail. Well, could this be something that's hereditary or not?
All right, let's go to Irv in Brunswick. Hi, Irv.
Good afternoon. I think that my question is turned into a comment just based on the pharmacist that you talked to a while ago. I've been diagnosed with two factors, Leiden factor 5 and prothrombus, and perhaps a couple of others that they haven't tested. So I've been on Coumadin for an extended period of time. My doctor and I have decided not to go to some of the newer things that are available because of the inability to reverse the issue if a blood if an operation or something is coming up. And I notified my daughters as they were approaching pregnancy age and my son so that the family is fully aware. Thank you for this program.
Thank you, Irv. So the factors he's talking about, those are predispositions to clotting? Is that what that is?
Yes. So the two he spoke to were some of the genetic predisposition that we talked about before that may put you at higher risk in that. So
okay. Let's go now to Pittsfield and Paul. Paul in Pittsfield. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Keith. Thanks very much for taking my call. Hello, everyone. My case is I have lymphedema. And I've had a Doppler done, and both legs have some loss of vascular tone and sluggish valves. I practice lymph massage. I've learned how to do that. I wear graduated compression stockings and a 30-40 millimeters of mercury. And my question is, do vasodilators – let me also add, I'm also taking a beta blocker for a heart problem – that I've recovered from, and 81 milligram aspirin once a day. However, I wanted to know if vasodilators, such as enhancements like sildenafil and tadalafil, or even tamsulosin for BPH, will increase risk of complications with DVT or PE problems. That's it.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. I'm not sure what his question is, but from a layman's standpoint. But sure. Dr. Zamrak, help us understand what Paul's talking about.
Sure. So I'm guessing more asking about if vasodilators are maybe helpful or maybe worsening the lymphedema or any other valvular.
And
I mean,
those are
veins.
Medications that expand the
yes.
The vas and the vessels.
So to kind of answer that question to the best of my ability, those medications are usually used to treat high blood pressure or hypertension. Sometimes in pulmonary hypertension, and those are really act more on the artery side of the system than on the vein side of the system. So I can't really say one way or another if it would help or hurt, but you know, just knowing how the medications work, it's more on the artery side, so not necessarily on the vein side.
Okay, and you're all in agreement on that. Okay, let's go to Lubeck and Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a statement, I guess, to make and maybe hear some comments after. I am a nurse. I had been diagnosed with stage 3 thyroid cancer 2 years ago, and I went to Boston Hospital for a neck dissection. And I did not have any VTE prophylaxis before the surgery. After the surgery, sequential compression was ordered for my legs. I was in the hospital for a couple days, and on day 8, after I was home, I was extremely short of breath, and long story short, I did have a pulmonary embolism. And I'd like the panel to comment on the range of symptoms for a PE, because they do vary and are not always easy to diagnose. And secondly, I would just like there some more remarks, perhaps, on what patients can do for themselves prior to surgery, as far as asking your surgeon what the plan is for prophylaxis, what the plan is prior to surgery, and then after surgery as well.
Cindy Esbjornson?
Karen, I love your call. Thank you so much for calling in. And so much of what I'm going to say is going to go back to the idea that just the fact that you called in and you've brought awareness to our entire listening audience right now is probably the most helpful thing that you can do. And you said, you know, what can you do or what can you ask your doctor about? The mere fact that you're engaging with your doctor and bringing this to the forefront is such a powerful thing. And first, let me say I'm really sorry you suffered from a pulmonary embolism and that you're, you know, suffering with the cancer and everything else in your picture. But thank you for helping everyone else out there. So first question was symptoms of a pulmonary embolism. And yes, you're right. They can be extremely elusive. And this is why we lose so many patients. Sometimes there is no shortness of breath. Sometimes there's just a faster heart rate than normal. People might feel like their heart is pounding. Sometimes we don't even see that until literally it's too late. It goes back to the clot that started the pulmonary embolism. Sometimes people will feel like they just strained a muscle. Sometimes they won't get any warning at all. So being aware is half the battle with all of the symptoms. We can list symptoms till the cows come home, but someone can be feeling those same symptoms and say, oh, I've got a strained muscle, or oh, I'm just having, you know, a little flare of my asthma. If you're not aware the problem exists, you won't respond accordingly. So definitely understanding all of the symptoms is the power here, and recognizing that they can be associated with these issues that we're talking about. You said there is a second part to your question, and I'm losing it.
Well, one, she did mention, and you sort of addressed this, but should we be as patients heading into any of these procedures that could cause risk factors be more aggressive in looking out for our own self-preservation interests and demanding, prophylactic treatments for blood clots?
I feel like aggressive might not be the right word, but we are our own best advocates, no matter where we are, especially in the medical community. And maybe not demanding prophylaxis, but engaging your doctor with pros and cons and certain situations. And there are some surgeries that are much higher risk than other surgeries. There are some patients who are in a much higher risk. Just by virtue of having cancer going into a surgery, we've already established that that's an acquired hypercoagulable state. So that's already increasing your chance of complications compared to the 18-year-old who goes in for an appendectomy or something along those lines. So just identifying, stratifying, and paying attention to reacting to those risks.
Okay. To Arlen Falls and Rodney. Hi, Rodney.
Hi there.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is Rodney Willett in Arlen Falls. Excuse me. I have DVT in both legs, and they started to move, and I went to Bangor and was treated with a trap ease, T-R-A-P-E-Z-E, by a doctor there to, if in the vena cava, if the blood clots moved, they attached them and waited for them to, and took care of the being dissolved.
Trapeze.
Yeah? Trapeze. Yes, so, it's a filter or whatever you want to call it.
That's right. So it's a type of IVC filter. So that's a little umbrella device that sits in the belly vein. And the idea is that it would catch any of these big clots that originate from the legs before it goes to the lungs. And so it's not so much a treatment for DVT as it is to try to prevent a lung clot. Now, an important thing to note is that really is only for patients that have either failed blood thinning, meaning that they've thrown a lung clot, or have spread of DVT despite being on therapeutic Coumadin or Xarelto or any of the heparins, that type of thing, or if they can't take a blood thinning agent because they're at risk for bleeding themselves. And those are the reasons for placing an IVC filter. Now, the other thing I want to add, just because, you know, to sort of plug this clinical trial that I'm a part of, is that we've mentioned so far the medications that are involved for treating DVT and have been around, at least for Coumadin, you know, 50 to 60 years and really hasn't changed as far as our treatment. But there is actually a procedure that's now around, and actually it's been around for at least a decade or more, where we actually directly go in and dissolve the clot in the leg veins. And it's designed to be what we call a minimally invasive procedure. So, you know, no scalpel or stitches or anything like that. We just enter a vein in the back of the leg, usually where the clot is, and we have some devices that actually either dissolve the clot directly or break up a clot, kind of suck it out. And this is designed to hopefully do two things. One is relieve the new symptoms of DVT, so, you know, the leg pain and swelling, but also prevent that damage to the leg vein that can happen over time such that you won't have the long-term swelling and pain.
How do you find clots? Is it x-ray?
So the most common is when they present with those symptoms we talked about already is to get an ultrasound. And, you know, pretty much every physician knows that. Is you get an ultrasound, it's a very sensitive and specific exam to find DVT. And based on that and where it's located, then the treatment.
All right, let's work in at least one more call if we can to Topsom and Frank. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, hi. Little background, I've got a Medtronic pacemaker. In fact, I'm on my second one for sick sinus syndrome. And then I also have a DVT, and that's being managed with Coumadin. And the question is there any way that I can do the INRs at home or in some other way than having to constantly go into the clinic? And the second part of that question is, I've got a little exercise machine under my computer desk. Are there any other devices like that or regimes that I should be following?
INR that he was?
Sure. So the INR is what we use to measure essentially how thin your blood is related to Coumadin for patients who are on Coumadin. So that's a very good question. I think that's a more of a conversation to have with who's following your Coumadin, your primary physician or your cardiologist. You know, if it's for whatever, I think that's more of a discussion to have there. I think there are benefits of being, you know, followed routine checkups, but there's also some benefits I understand of checking it yourself. So
right,
it's more of that discussion.
Yeah, and we can't really get into individual cases here, nor do we want to. But I appreciate your call and all of your calls today. About a minute left, so I guess Cindy Asbjornsen, this is the Awareness Month. we've tried to make people aware, but if anyone has questions, what's the first thing that they should do?
Obviously, reach out to a medical professional, and hopefully everyone has a good relationship with a medical professional that they can talk to. My door is always open. I'm at the Vein Healthcare Center. I'm happy to field vein questions or have full consultations for anyone who has venous issues. But there's a ton of information on the internet. There's a great webpage called Stop the Clot. There's a website called This Is Serious. My own website at theveinhealthcarecenter.com has great information about DVT, DVT prevention, and basic awareness. So reaching out to any of those resources is a great first step.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. Thank you all, Drs. Asbjornsen, Kim, and Zemrak. Thanks for being on Main Calling today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Cindy Asbjornsen is founder of the Vein Healthcare Center. Dr. Paul Kim, assistant director of vascular and interventional services for Spectrum Medical Group. And Dr. Wes Zemrak is doctor of pharmacy and anticoagulation specialist at Maine Medical Center. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcasts, by visiting mpbn.net/mainecalling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.